Hope, peace, joy, and love for you in the name of Christ our Lord. This is the aftermath. We've been through Christmas, all the anticipation, the celebrations, and now that return to the daily duty. It really is a letdown in many ways. How many of you have already taken down your decorations? How many of you are going to wait till next year to do it? Yeah, that's right. And, you know, it's just sort of one of those dreary tasks that's part of the aftermath. And after the birth narratives and the excitement, particularly from the perspective of Luke, after the conceptions of John the Baptist, which was miraculous, but from Jesus, which was divine, now that culmination with the angelic choir, the night of the birth in Bethlehem, and poof, we're in the aftermath. What we know after that is a little brief vignette of the presentation of Jesus in the temple upon 8 days after his birth that's narrated to us in the Gospel of Matthew. We know of his encounter in the temple with the authorities at the age of 12 when Mary and Joseph have a mix-up. He's with you. I thought he was with you. And all that delightful story when Jesus is basically coming into his own. But now this unusual event that is often conflated or telescoped together with the birth itself, it has absolutely nothing to do with the night of the birth, with the shepherds out in the pasture. It has nothing to do with the travel by donkey from Nazareth to Bethlehem. It has nothing to do with the temple presentation thereafter from the birth itself, or with the encounter years later. This is a moment within 2 years and after 1 year that's unspecified. It is a moment of sheer terror in the life of Joseph and Mary. And you'll notice how often, once again, from the Matthean perspective, everything is told to us through his eyes, that is, the eyes of Joseph. The angel speaks to him on multiple occasions, advising him of what he should do to protect his family. But the story is moved by these stargazers. They're called wise men, which is truly a euphemism, meaning that it's speaking well of them, when in point of fact, they are a combination of spooky astrologers as well as scientific astronomers. They were prognosticators who literally gazed at the skies and tried to chart the course of the heavenly bodies. And when they did this, this is where it gets spooky, they coordinated a chart on the ground, a two-dimensional map, to correspond to the celestial activities. And so now, according to this simple formula, what happens in the skies will foretell or bespeak events on Earth. These celestial bodies will give terrestrial momentary advance or warning or celebration. So then, they're way off in the east. They are clearly of Mesopotamian origin, with Persian fame and Babylonian science and Arabian gifts. And they notice some star in the sky. Astronomers have had fun trying to chart this, what would have happened around anywhere between 10 AD and 10 BC. And they've suggested that Venus burned brightly, or that Saturn and Jupiter lined up, or that there was an unnoticed meteor or perhaps a comet. But nothing can be documented, and with good reason. This is not one of those miracles that has as its root a normal phenomenon that God is using according to his timing. But rather, this is something that really cannot be explained, because the star doesn't behave like a normal celestial body. It does at first. It just appears in the sky and gets the attention of these magi. And they now see that it coordinates with the quadrant of Israel. And they associate it with the birth of a king according to their logistics. And now then, remarkably, because it seems to be such a phenomenal birth and a phenomenal ground-changing, game-changing, life-changing event, they will note it for their benefit as well as for their own countrymen, so that later they will receive favor in the eyes of this future ruler.
Off they go.
Once again, the traditional Catholic view has it dead wrong, as if there are only three of these fellows, when in point of fact, they're in a caravan. It wouldn't be safe for three of them to travel. They had an entourage. What's three are the number of gifts. And immediately we can sense the importance of the moment by the gifts. Gold, frankincense, and myrrh they bring with them, but not in sufficient quantity to attract robbers and thieves. These are merely token quantities that would be appropriate to give to a child ruler. Not a treasury, if you will, that would endow him for life or the family, but mementos of, that bespeak of the esteem that which the travelers hold this future king. Gold, of course, you understand easily. It has value. It always has. The most precious mineral on earth. It's been used for almost everything, as well as commerce. But it even has constructive properties. I've got it in my teeth. How about you? It's all over the place of importance and value, more so than silver and bronze and copper and the like. Frankincense and myrrh are interesting resins from a tree that's derived from the sap. But they have distinct purposes. This is not some fancy French perfume in a bottle, but rather this clumpy, lumpy resin that's in a burlap bag. And it's been used for two different purposes that are quite distinct. The frankincense was associated throughout the Middle East with worship. It was the incense of the religious sanctuaries, you might say, whether they be horribly pagan or whether they be Jewish. It was the fragrance, the aroma of reverence. Myrrh was a little different. Myrrh was often boiled down to an oil. It was used for funeral rites. It was used to anoint a cadaver, to combat the odor of decomposition. And so we have here some nifty little symbols and the gifts of what we know to be the rest of the story, that Jesus is more precious than silver and gold. And that he is to be worshipped, and that he will die as the atonement for our sin. Although that's not the direct idea of Matthew necessarily, but it's the implied, indicated meaning of these gifts for future reference. The stargazers arrive, and they encounter King Herod, who is now almost identified as if he's a poacher, occupying a throne that's not his anymore because of this remarkable birth that's been noted in the skies. He knows nothing of this phenomenon. His people have not have paid any attention to some astral phenomenon that has drawn their attention, which would once again indicate that this is an epiphany to the stargazers and not to the whole world, as we'll see. But anyway, they arrive and they unsettle the king. It says in the translations he was troubled. He was downright agitated. He was disturbed. And all of Israel with him, all of Judea with him. And jolly well they should be, because he was a paranoid, murderous despot. He was a brutal dictator. Now, just to speak favorably of him, he was the ruler for 40 years and Israel prospered under him. A remarkable builder, aqueducts, a whole city with docks by the port called Caesarea. Get it? Caesar, Caesarea. It was been, the archaeologists had a lot of fun excavating it, and it's remarkable, its dimensions, and it was the equivalent of a Las Vegas in Israel. What happened in Caesarea stayed in Caesarea. It was for the Roman soldiers. It was where they barracked. It was so they wouldn't be miserable. It was so they'd stay on their quarters and not drift into the countryside where they would be reviled. They didn't want to see the Jews, and the Jews didn't want to see them. And so Herod built his palace, and he built the Tower of Antonia, the wife of Caesar, next to the palace, so that when on those infrequent occasions the soldiers had to go into Jerusalem or into Israel, into the interior, they would have a place to stay. And once again, they could be quarantined from the people and the people from them, so that would minimize conflict. And now then, He has engaged in a project to endear himself to the Israelites to remodel the temple. He wants to return it to its Solomonic splendor. It's a project that was still ongoing in the life of Jesus to be completed after his resurrection. The temple had its remodeling project finished for only 20 years before it was destroyed. Now this is generous, and how he's paying for it is far different from Solomon, who taxed his people to death. But rather, he will give rebates. He will give incentives. He offers only taxes on commerce, such that the people are in effect contributing without knowing it so much, without feeling it so much, because Rome has given them all kinds of benefits. Rome basically leaves Israel alone because they like Herod. Herod plays nice with them, and he has a keen, sophisticated political savvy. He knows who's going to be Caesar before that person becomes Caesar. Every time he backs the right horse for that political race, without fail. Furthermore, he pays his tributes on time or early, and he does so in a way that's cooperative and helpful and offers to do anything they want, as long as they'll kind of leave him alone. And they do. It's a symbiotic relationship that gives Israel a chance to flourish after the Maccabean revolt and recover some of its wealth, its standing, and its identity. So now then, we're at this moment where you would think these stargazers would be greeted by a friendly ruler. But no, we must remember that in spite of his achievements, Herod was a despotic, paranoid assassin. He killed three of his sons. He killed his own brother. Now, by the way, these weren't entirely unusual in royal courts. Such was the nature of competitive jealousies that often family members would be killed in order to gain the throne. Very tragic. But he went beyond this. He killed his brother-in-law so that his brother-in-law would not be high priest. He was disturbed that his wife sent a nude portrait to Mark Antony of herself. So he sent his best friend in to try to seduce her. He came out and said, "She won't budge." And he said, "You're lying," and then killed them both. Now that he's got a mother-in-law problem. His mother-in-law is a little distressed with him, as you can imagine. He has killed off her daughter, her son, three grandsons, and now she'd kind of like to get rid of him. And so she engages in a plot to overthrow him and to murder him. And naturally, he's got spies everywhere and knows about it. And then she knows that he knows that she's about to do it. So she tries to escape. And then he knows that she knows that he knows that. And he knows how she's going to try to escape. And this, by the way, is my favorite mother-in-law story. She hides herself in a casket and has a companion to try to carry her out of the city. The casket is intercepted by Herod's soldiers. They open the caskets, kill her, and put her right back in it, send her to the grave. Isn't that a great mother-in-law story? Boom, it's over. And this is the man. And so when Herod's disturbed, everybody's worried. And this is why we jump ahead to the end of the story. It's not exactly unusual or the least bit surprising that he would have ordered an edict to kill all the babies and baby boys under the age of 2 in Bethlehem. This was perfectly in line with his character, because on his deathbed, he ordered an edict that everybody in the whole land of Judea, that the head of the household be killed, in order that the people would mourn at his funeral. The edict was ignored, of course. But that's the nature of the beast here. He's satanic. And so when those innocent stargazers arrive, just following a celestial light, and they make inquiry about a king, he's alarmed and doesn't understand why, where, who, or what. He's clueless. And why shouldn't he be? He's an Idumean half-breed who resented the Jewish aristocracy, the Jewish temple establishment. He was always resentful of those who could proudly proclaim their pedigree, so he had the registry ransacked, vandalized, and burned, and there were no rabbinic records. If he wasn't going to be a Jew, they weren't either. And when he's troubled, they're all worried. He beckons in the chief priests, the scribes, in other words, the temple priests and the rabbinic class, and all of these so-called wise men of Israel. Get it? Wise men and wise men. And so he asked them, what about this? What's the deal here? Why here? Why now? And they give him an answer that comes out of the Old Testament. There'll be four or five references to Old Testament verses in this story. This is one about Bethlehem, house of bread. And from you, your humble little suburb of Jerusalem, this little podunk that was really a shepherd town, you will be the seat of the hometown, the seat of a great ruler. So then, the wise men leave and depart, and actually they're less counseled by the Jewish class than they are by that star. They depart with a sort of an idea or a clue, but it's not the information that they gain from Herod that helps them. But now we go back to that star. Its behavior is not normal. It no longer is just in the sky in an area that could be associated with a quadrant. It is now hovering. The language describes it as literally being over the house, kind of like a flashlight or like a beacon or like a drone or like a UFO. It's behaving in a way that's not normal for any luminary, although there are many explanations about atmospheric conditions and swamp gas and the like. All of that's true, but now then this star has gotten more and more specific the closer they get to the location. And now it directs them not to the neighborhood, but to the specific location of the family and of the child. He's now a toddler, at the very least, a one-year-old, at the very least, possibly getting closer to two. And they bring their gifts. And for this moment in the Gospel of Matthew, there's great importance to him, because these are the first Gentile worshipers, period. It's the answer to a trivial pursuit question. Who are the first Gentiles to worship Jesus? Who are the first ones to acknowledge him as king or as Lord or as ruler? Now, how much they understood at that point is totally unclear. There's no evidence in the scriptures that angels have spoken to them until they're told to leave by a different route. But now there's some sense in these common Gentiles that this is important, that the Lord is speaking, that the God of the universe is moving and has made a declaration that matters to them, to these Gentiles. And they come and worship him. Their behavior is that of obeisance and adoration and supplication. They may not understand the full import of what Jesus will do and what he will mean, but they are at the nascent beginnings. They are at the core, at the very start, at the seedbed of the faith. And Luke and Matthew describes them as such. So now, the story continues, and we see that they are advised to depart by a different way, and Herod is furious, and all of his homicidal tendencies come to full flower. He orders the edict in a rage. And then the saying was how true it was, that it was safer to be a pig than a son of Herod. There's a glitch or an ellipsis, a time lapse, and we don't know how long, that the family flees to Egypt. But it is curious for Matthew how important this is, because Jesus is the completion of the Mosaic Law. He is the new Moses, the new Abraham, the new Adam. And inasmuch, he will go to this Sinai Peninsula, much like Moses in a little basket on the Nile River, and there receive protection among exiles for a while, until which time an angel once again appears to Joseph and advises him that it's all right to return because Herod has died. Estimates now would be around the age of 5 or 7 for Jesus, somewhere in that time period. What does all this mean? Where would we take it? And what's our devotional application or a homiletic exhortation? I would like to suggest to you that there are classes of people around us who we see in this story. And the first one are the rather obvious, the adversaries, the villains. Herod is someone we just love to hate. He's a villain that is despicable, and yet he has these achievements that make him noteworthy. He's not pure evil in the sense of being a demon, but he's at least half or three quarters, we would estimate. And he ranks down there with Mao Zedong and Joseph Stalin and the like. He's one of those kind of characters who built at the expense of others. But in any event, there he is, and there's a whole world of adversaries around us. They hate the news. They hate our views. They don't like us for who we are and whose we are. They don't like what we say and what we do. They want us to conform to them. They want us to serve their needs. They're adversaries. They've got their dukes up. They're hateful. They're mean. They're ugly. They're looking for a fight. They're looking for an excuse. And it's not, it reminds me of a saying we had from the 60s, just because you don't think somebody's after you doesn't mean they are not. That's a little bit of a drug-related saying, you know, looking around, paranoid. But there's this this idea here that we're comfortable and we're safe here. We have it good in these here United States. But there are people around the world who would do us in, would do us harm, and who are adversaries in the true sense. And they need the gospel. They need to hear it. There are also the apathetic around us. People who just don't care. They don't care, they don't want to care, they never have cared, and they're not going to they're not going to be chided into caring. They're unresponsive. They think they already know the answers. They're like the scribes and the chief priests and the temple hierarchy. It's their system, it's their way, and they cannot be told anything. And they're apathetic to God's truth because it interferes with their comfort and their own narrative. This is the way things are. They're settled with it. They don't want any change. And they don't want to be usurped. It's their system. It's not the Lord's. And that's why they're so apathetic to the truth, because it would unsettle them. And then there are these folks like the Magi who engender in us sort of a tender yearning. We'd like to reach them because they're seekers. They're lookers. They're trying. They're routing around. They want to connect the dots. They're trying to piece things together in their own limited way. They just don't have all the parts. The parts are moving and they don't have them, and they don't understand. They need somebody to come alongside and explain it to them. That's what they need. And that's what they want. These stargazers, for all their astrology, there really is a great deal of astronomy. They want to learn. They're teachable. And there are folks around us who are outside the camp who don't need a star anymore. They just need a word from a witness, someone who can share the gift that we have received, someone who can illuminate, illustrate, and otherwise elucidate what has been granted. Because we weren't born with it either. We've received it as a gift. And we looked and sought. We want to learn. We're here to be better and better and more like Christ. And then at the end of the story, there are the commoners, and there's just a sort of a footnote here that Jesus is up in Nazareth. And it's a very debated and obscure reference. What does Matthew mean when he says that this scripture might be fulfilled, that he's a Nazarene? Because Nazareer is a Hebrew word that means root. So is he talking to his root of Jesse and back to David? That would be okay. Is there some other passage in Apocrypha or elsewhere or an old rabbinic saying that he's mentioning? Not likely. Matthew wouldn't do that. He would document everything. And so more likely is a third possibility, that he's using the actual word itself, its definition. And we look at the etymology of Nazir or Nazarene, it means those who are the commoners who may be despised and forsaken. Now remember, he's God with us. God with all of us, not God with just the fancy folks or the ones who are entitled, but rather to the commoners who would be despised by the superiors, the inferiors, if you were, to the Nazarenes, the folks in the hill country in a hard scrabble living who have absolutely no privileges, very few pleasures of life, to the outcast, to the overlooked, to the unwanted and the unwashed, the commoners. He is Emmanuel with the covenant people, with all the folks. Now, this is not to denigrate the wealthy or those who have achieved, but rather that he is also with those who are poor and those who have achieved little, that he's God with all of us. Therefore, he's not born of the temple precincts, but rather of an integrated province of Israel, where there was a caravan route and Gentiles passed, and there was a hard life and a brutal realities all around. The folks who cared the most, perhaps, about their faith and what God has meant to them and what God means to them and what God will mean to them. God with us. God with all of us commoners. With us, the anonymous folks who are easily forgotten or overlooked. God with us because he has come to save us. Jesus, the one who delivers, redeems, restores, renews. Jesus, the one who should be worshipped by all, who changed the world by saving us from our sins.